Audio Mystery Theatre presents The Ornamental Hermit, a D.S. Billings mystery. Part 9, Sebastian's Story.
What have I done? This is the end of me. Mr. Jacobs will have exposed those photographs by now. I'll be arrested the moment I walk into the office. Everyone will be standing around watching, sniggering.
Hello, Detective Sergeant Billy.
Good morning, Sergeant. So far, so good. The desk sergeant greeted me as normal. Nobody is looking at me strangely. Jacob's hat and coat are in the cloakroom, so he's definitely here. But he hasn't done anything yet. Maybe he's biding his time. I need to talk to him. Mr. Jacobs? Mr. Jacobs, it's Billings. What the? Something's blocking the door. Mr. Jacobs? Mr. Jacobs, are you in there? I can't open the door. There's something blocking it. Mr. Jacobs? Oh, my God. Mr. Jacobs, are you all right? Oh, damn it, I can't open the door. Are you there? You must help me. There's something wrong with the inspector.
What?
Inspector Jacobs. He's on the floor. I can't get into his office. He's blocking the door.
What's he doing on the floor?
He collapsed. He must have had a heart attack or something. What? Don't just stand there. Go get the surgeon.
I'm going.
Maybe I can slip in through this gap. I'm in. Mr. Jacobs, are you all right? Oh, he's unconscious, but he's still breathing. There's something on his desk. Arsenic. Did he poison himself? What's this? The photographs. There's a note. Never let yourself be bought. He left this here for me to find. And what's this? It's a letter explaining everything. His dealings with Bowden Krimsky. It's a confession. He confessed.
No. I don't. There he is.
Thank God you're here. He's poisoned himself. We must get him to the surgery at once.
Well, Mr. Billings and Mr...
Thompson, sir. James Thompson.
This is a nasty business. I wasn't expecting to have to investigate the suspected suicide of one of our inspectors when I came into work this morning. Now, there was a letter on his desk when you came in. Isn't that right, Detective Sergeant Billings?
That's right. It's the letter you're holding. I found it in an envelope on his desk.
Did you find anything else?
A bottle of arsenic.
And nothing else?
No, sir. Just those two things.
I understand that it was you who urged him to write this confession letter.
Yes, sir. I saw him at his house yesterday.
And what did you talk to him about?
Well, I told him I knew about his plot with Bowden Krimsky, and I urged him to confess it to you.
Why?
Because an innocent man's life was at stake. The wrong person had been arrested for Lord Palmer's murder, and Mr. Jacobs and Mr. Krimsky were trying to frame him. How is Mr. Jacobs, sir? Is he all right?
Never you mind how he is. And what about you?
What about me, sir?
Are you involved in this plot?
Plot, sir?
This blackmailing plot.
No, sir. I have nothing to do with this. I was merely passing by when Detective Sergeant Billings called for my assistance.
Please, sir, I wasn't trying to blackmail him. I was merely trying to...
Be quiet. You can go now. I'd like to talk to Sergeant Billings on my own.
Yes, sir.
Please, sir, you must tell me how Inspector Jacobs is doing. I am very concerned.
He's having his stomach pumped out as we speak.
I never expected he'd do something like this.
What did you expect? Or should I ask, how much?
I am telling you, sir, it had not been my intention to blackmail him.
Then what was your intention?
I had discovered that Inspector Jacobs had become embroiled in an illicit plot with Bowden Krimsky, and I wanted to give him an opportunity to explain himself before alerting you.
This... Sebastian Forrester, a.k.a. Brendan Loughrane, a.k.a. the Wild Man of Sutton Courtney. This is a friend of yours, I believe.
He is a family acquaintance.
He confessed to killing Lord Palmer.
That confession was induced from him by Inspector Jacobs. He retracted it later.
That's right. That's what this is. His retraction. Rather long retraction, I must say. It's practically a novel. Didn't you visit him in his cell the day that this was written?
That's right, sir.
And was it upon your recommendation that he wrote it?
I knew that his confession was false, sir. I knew he couldn't have killed Lord Palmer. There was no reason for him to do so.
Then why did he confess?
It's complicated, sir. Sebastian has a self-destructive streak about him.
Sebastian?
I meant Mr. Forrester, sir. He was down and out at the time, and death must have seemed like a relief to him.
And what made him change his mind?
I believe it was seeing his mother.
His mother?
She came with me to his cell.
His mother is Cecilia Forrester, wife of Frederick Forrester, who also happens to have been your guardian.
That's right, sir. They looked after me when my parents died.
I see. This arsenic, then, where did that come from?
I don't know, sir.
You believe he took it himself?
I do, sir.
And why would he do that?
I believe he felt ashamed, sir.
Ashamed?
He is a proud and honest man, sir.
Not that honest, Billings, if your accusation is true.
He must have felt very desperate, sir, to have agreed to Mr. Krimsky's proposition. We all have our weaknesses.
Well, I suppose we will just have to wait, won't we? Until Jacobs recovers, which his doctors assured me he will, and see what he has to say about all this. As for this Barnabas Crook, I suppose we'd better alert the Berkshire Constabulary and the River Police to see if they can pick him up. And we'd better alert the magistrate, too, and let this Mr. Forrester go, because I agree with you. It doesn't look like we have enough of a case against him. But, as for you, Billings, I don't think you've handled this at all well. You should have come to me if you had any suspicions. You should never have let it come to this.
I realize that now, sir.
You can go home now, Billings. You're still under suspension, and that won't be lifted until after we've cleared this whole thing up. And that won't be until after Jacobs has recovered.
Sir, I was wondering if...
Now, what is it, Billings?
May I read Mr. Forrester's retraction?
Statement written by Sebastian Forrester, Tuesday the 2nd of December, 1890. I found myself wandering the streets of Whitehaven in the summer of 1880. It is not necessary for you to know how I landed there. Suffice to say that this was just one stop in a much longer journey, the route and destination of which were in the hands of a greater power and completely unknown to me. I remember stumbling through the cobbled streets of the West Strand, penniless and mute, listening to the rhythm of the surf crashing against the shore. In the whisper of the wind and the waves, I suddenly heard a voice calling me. It was the sea. "Climb onto my waves," it said, "and let me take you to paradise." I was younger then, and passionate and ignorant and desperate to do something glorious. But I was also ill. I recognize that now. The infection in my mouth had given me a fever, and I was burning up and sweating profusely. What I then considered to have been a religious experience, I now know to have been mere delirium. I must have collapsed at that point and fainted, because the next thing I remember is waking up on a pile of skins in a small brick room with three unknown men staring down at me and muttering words of concern.
He's awake! Philip, he's awake! You fainted, good man. Just out there by the pier. What's your name?
I put my lips together and was about to utter Brendan when I suddenly remembered that I had no tongue. It had been 3 or 4 days since the episode where I lost my tongue, but only now did I feel the first pang of regret.
He's thirsty. Go fetch him some water, Oswald.
Aye, sir.
My name is Jonas Cranson, and this is my son, Philip. We are Cranson and Son. This is our tannery you're in. Where's the water, Oswald?
Come in, sir.
There you go. Have a drink, good man. Drink as much as you can. Oh, he wants more. Well, go on, get him some more.
Yes, sir.
I downed the second cup as avidly as the first. When I felt the hot, throbbing flush in my head ease away, I placed the empty cup on the ground and pushed myself up. I don't know whether it was the stench of the tanning liquor or being confined in that small brick room with three strangers towering and fussing over me. But something made me want to get up and walk out of the room.
Hey, what are you doing? Don't get up, good man. You're not well.
I stumbled past the large pits with skins soaking and out the door. I instantly felt the fresh breeze hit my face and heard the roar of waves crashing against the pier. That call I'd heard before I fainted hadn't ceased. If anything, it had become stronger. A strange instinct led me back to the pier, and there I sat, still and upright, listening to the meditative rhythm of the ebb and the flow, longing, like St. Brendan of Clonfert, to be set adrift on this watery desert. I was still there the following morning, shivering on the outside but flushing hot inside, when two men approached me.
It's him, Dad. Look, the man who fainted in the tannery.
Hey, yo. What's that doing here? You'll catch the death of you, you will, sitting out here. Looks like you're halfway there already.
But look, Dad. Money.
The boy was pointing at some coins which had miraculously appeared on the ground before me. How did those coins get there? Had an early morning stroller mistaken me for a beggar and thrown the coins at me?
And you should be careful with that and all. Has you not got a pocket that you can keep them in?
I was wearing the clothes given to me by the Whitehaven police, as I had none of my own. A pair of woolen trousers, a shirt, and a long, ragged frock coat with no pockets.
Ah, well, I'll keep them for you then. I'll put them in my pocket. You should be more careful, man. 'Tis a nasty place he has landed in, full of robbers and bandits and thieves. Hey, Oswald?
Aye, full of robbers and thieves.
Why doesn't you come with us? We've got a bed, and this'll do nicely for the rent. Come along, I'll make you a nice cup of hot grog. That'll warm you up. My name is Crook, by the way. Barnabas Crook. But you can call me Barney.
There is a certain quality to my face which has always attracted the pity of others. I have often heard people speak of my melancholy eyes. Perhaps it's the shape of them, or the colour, but there is something about them that moves people to care for me. I have taken advantage of this all my life. My mother, Mr. Crickshaw, Janie Drew. They've all put up with things they would otherwise not have tolerated because of my eyes. Barnabas Crook took advantage of them too. He had me sit on street corners all day long and beg for money. I didn't mind. I was happy to sit still all day, ignoring the discomforts of the weather and staring ahead of me and meditating, only moving on when I was told to do so by the police. I earned mostly pennies and farthings, but occasionally there'd be a shilling or even a half crown. I could make up to 6 shillings on a good day just by sitting still and looking pitiful. Crook would pocket the money, and in exchange he'd give me a bed and a warm meal every day. My desire to set out to sea, though, had not left me. So when I was not begging, I was on the moorland, constructing a curragh. I had studied St. Brendan's Navigatio, and was very clear about how to construct such a vessel. I assembled some timber to build the frame, and stitched together a dozen or so oak-soaked hides around it. Crook, of course, was in a good position to provide me with the hides, and was willing to do so. On a cold November night, when everyone was asleep, I went down to the dock, climbed into my ramshackle vessel, and rowed off to meet the waves. The night was cold, but the wind was smooth and the sea was calm. My sail billowed gently as I left the protection of the pier, and the boat started skipping over the waves, almost hovering over the sea. There was a pang of doubt as I looked back and saw the shoreline move farther away from me, but I quickly sank down into the hull and turned towards the stars, biting my lips and fighting back my tears. Never look back at a burning bridge, I thought. No good can come from that, as Lot's wife would surely testify. Although the sea remained calm throughout the journey, the boat was so light it twisted and curled over every wave, making me profoundly sick. I spent 6 nights on that boat, most of them curled up in a puddle of my own vomit. It was agony. After 3 days of nausea, I lost all sensation in my limbs. The spray of the waves kept splashing over my face as I lay half-conscious in the hull, making my skin sticky and salty, and the seagulls kept circling over the boat and screeching. Every now and then, a daring gull would come down and land on my disabled body, like a vulture on a carcass, to pick up a morsel of my throw-up. I drank little and ate less. I had taken enough food and water to last 7 days, but all this proved unnecessary, because on the 7th day, my boat was hurled onto a rock off the coast of Whithorn, and I was thrown onto a rock pool, where I was rescued by a local fisherman. I remained in Whithorn for 10 years, living among the fishermen, sailors, and dock workers. I waited patiently for another sign from God, for an indication of my purpose in this desolate outpost. But none came. God had become silent, and I was left stranded, spiritually and physically. After 5 years of waiting, doubts finally started creeping in. Had I misinterpreted everything? Had this powerful yearning to leave behind my life of comfort and follow God's call been nothing more than a fantasy? Had this been nothing more than the usual restlessness of youth? If so, all my sacrifices had been for nothing. I tried desperately to regain those glorious old passions by committing acts of random asceticism. At one point, I even drove a nail into my palm, but it was all in vain. The passion was missing, and had been replaced by feelings of uselessness, frustration, and regret. It was a dark episode of my life, and it pains me to remember it. There is one person in particular, whose name I do not wish to mention, who has been wronged by me and who deserved better. Should the contents of this report ever come back to her, I want her to know that I am sorry. All I can say is that hope is a desperate thing. Man clings to it for much longer than he should, and it took me 10 years to realize that. So I left, suddenly and unexpectedly, escaping once again a life which had become dead, dull, and unbearable. I wandered throughout the country, slowly edging southwards, sleeping in sheds and haystacks, indulging in the charity of others, and working wherever I could. I wanted to return to the life I left behind, but I didn't dare. I was ashamed, ashamed of the wretch I had become, ashamed of the pain and grief I had imposed on my parents. By January, I had drifted down to Berkshire. It was just outside the village of Appleford when I picked up a discarded newspaper to line my coat and saw Lord Palmer's advertisement. He was looking for a hermit to live on his estate and was offering 3 shillings a week and £100 bonus after completing a full year. It was providence. God had finally spoken again and had offered me a way out of my predicament. I could pull myself together with £100, set myself up in some sort of business. I might even bring myself to be reunited with my parents. And so I went to Sutton Courtenay and applied for the position. I can't deny it was hard. I was used to living like a stray cur in the privacy of my own degradation, but to do so in plain sight of others and for their amusement was a humiliating experience. But I consoled myself with the notion that this was the lesson God had wanted me to learn. I had reached rock bottom and could only rise from this a wiser and more enlightened man. As I was chopping wood one morning, I heard someone calling in the woods. I went down to the river and saw a narrowboat floating gently by, with 2 figures of my past standing on it, grinning broadly at me.
Hey, up, look who it is.
It was Barnabas Crook and his son, Oswald.
And so it is, they. I heard downriver that they were living in the estate of some rich lord. A tongueless wild man, they said. Well, I thought, that can only be our good friend Brendan. And here you are. So you survived then? When I saw that rickety old boat you were making, I was sure that you'd drown. Where's this posh house, then? Stone me, is that it? That's your house? You has it made, you has. That door there, I wager that's the kitchen door. You could leave that open at nights. What's the matter? Don't you want to help out an old friend? It's me, Barnabas Crook. I saved your life back in Whitehaven. Remember? Oh, I see. You want the whole loot for yourselves then, don't you? You greedy little bastard.
Hey, Da, look at this. Can always use this axe.
Ooh, that'll do just fine, son. We could break down the door with this.
Who are you? We don't tolerate poachers here.
What's this? Lord of the house, is it?
Green, bring me my shotgun. I have a pair of gypsy parasites here.
Here, who are you calling a gypsy parasite?
You are trespassing on my property, and that's a criminal offence.
Oi! Let go of me arm.
You will stay right here until my man arrives with my shotgun. Then I will personally frog march you to Abingdon Police Station. Green, where's the shotgun?
Maester, you have gone too far. Take your hands off my son.
Speak English, man. I can't understand a word you say.
Let go of me son now, you hears, or I will use this on you.
You put that thing down this very instant. I will not be threatened on my own land by a pair of thugs.
I ain't gonna warn you again, maester. Let go of me son.
It's not mister, it's lord. You'll have the decency of calling me sir, you impudent rascal.
Right, that's it. Yeah! Quickly, Oswald, grab what you can from his pockets and run back to the boat. You better come back with us, Brendan, or they'll think it was you.
I remained frozen on the spot, staring at Lord Palmer's body with horror.
Aren't you coming or what?
I shook my head.
Well, suit yourself. Go on, Oswald, push us off.
As I watched them sail away, I realised I had made a mistake. I knew this murder would be blamed on me. I ran after them, waving frantically, begging them to stop, but it was too late. Why did this have to happen now? Why did God raise my hopes only to dash them so cruelly? But then it struck me. Of course. How could I have been so stupid? It wasn't enough to abandon my worldly possessions and escape to the Lake District. It wasn't enough to cut off my tongue or to suffer an excruciating boat trip. I was responsible for the loss of two lives, that of Janie Drew and her unborn child. I deserved all of this, and much worse. Although I continued following the boat, I knew I had no hope of escaping. Lord Palmer's body would soon be discovered, and the police would be called. They'd follow my tracks and pick me up. In due course, I'd be tried and hanged, but still I continued walking down the river. I was in a state of trance, or was it shock? I had lost all hope of ever recovering my old life. My life was over now. Finally, after all these years, I had given myself over completely to the will of God. I had only a short time left to live, and this time would truly be spent as though crucified, in struggle, in lowliness of spirit, in goodwill and spiritual abstinence, in fasting, in penitence, in weeping. I don't need to write down what happened after that. I've been behind bars several weeks now, preparing myself for my final fate. I was ready to hang, until suddenly another figure from my past re-entered my life. This time it was John Billings, my father's ward. He's the one who convinced me to write down this narrative. I don't know whether it will save me from the gallows, and I don't care if it doesn't, but at least the truth can be known now.
Thank you.
Excuse me, nurse. I'm looking for Mr. Jacob's room.
It's that room over there. But he's got visitors at the moment. You can wait out here in the corridor.
Thank you.
Did he ask for money?
No, Chief Superintendent. He didn't ask for money.
Was there an implicit understanding that Detective Sergeant Billings would withdraw his accusations if you paid him some money?
No, sir. There was no understanding between me and Billings. Billings is entirely blameless. It was me who was in the wrong. Me. Just me.
How much money did Bowden Crim offer you to tip him off?
He offered to pay my debts, which amounted to £5,000. This was a loan, which I would have to pay back gradually from the rewards received for foiling his counterfeiting operation and the salary increase which might result from a possible promotion.
Promotion?
I assumed there might be a promotion in it for me.
Well, there's not going to be a promotion now, is there, Mr. Jacobs? Damn it, man, this is the turf fraud scandal all over again.
I think he knows that. There's no need to rub it in.
Be quiet, Winifred.
But he's talking to you like a common criminal.
Be quiet, I said.
How's your health?
Not very well, sir.
The doctor tells me you've lost the use of your right arm.
Partially.
And you're having difficulty walking.
The arsenic has affected my balance.
The doctor says you might never recover.
No.
We can't have you back in the force unless you do.
I realise that.
And you probably won't qualify for a pension after what you've done.
I am aware of that, too.
So, what will you do, then?
I shall just have to sell up, won't I?
You really got yourself into great mess, haven't you?
You're leaving already? The visitors will be gone soon. Just give them a few more minutes.
It's all right, nurse. I'll come back another day.
Dear John, I am sorry it has taken so long for me to write and thank you. But this has been a tumultuous time for us. I am afraid I shall have to start the letter with some bad news. Mr. Forrester has died. He died 2 days ago, with me and Sebastian by his side. Although he has been unconscious and confused a lot lately, he did have a moment of clarity when Sebastian grabbed his hand and held it in his grasp. Neither father nor son could speak, but I could see Mr. Forrester's eyes well up with love and gratitude, and I knew he had recognized him. It was shortly afterwards, in fact, that he died. But I am so glad that God has allowed him to see his beloved son one more time before he passed away. The other sad news is that Sebastian has gone away again. Please do not be sad for me. In a way, I am glad he has gone. He felt uncomfortable being at home. He was very unsure about himself and his inability to speak, and the odor from his mouth made him very reluctant to leave the house and interact with our friends, who have all been very kind and welcoming. He was also very restless. He slept little and paced about his room a lot. He mentioned in a letter that he had gone to the continent. I don't know what he will do, but at least I know he's still alive, and he knows where to reach me if he needs money. Mr. Forrester's funeral will take place on Thursday, the day after Christmas. You will come, won't you? You are the only family I have left. Yours lovingly, Cecilia Forrester.
God, we thank you for this food, for rest and home and all things good, for wind and rain and sun above, but most of all for those we love. Right, everyone on their feet. Well, come on, up you get.
What for?
Never mind what for, just do as you're told. Come on, all of you. Jimmy, Jane, on your feet. You too, Billings. We thank the Lord. Now it's time to thank Mr. Boogledug.
Who's Mr. Boogledug?
Mr. Boogledug is a very special friend of mine.
Oh, Samuel, you're being silly.
It's Mr. Boogledug we have to thank for this special meal. If it weren't for Mr. Boogledug, we'd have nothing to eat this Christmas, except for some roasted carrots and parsnips. See, Daddy don't make much money at Scotland Yard, unlike our friend Billings here. Hey, chum. Billings is a sergeant, you see, but Daddy just a constable. and I only earn a couple of shillings a week, and that ain't much. So there I was, wandering around Clapham Common, wondering what to feed my family this Christmas, when suddenly I saw Mr. Boogledug pecking and picking and fluttering about on the lawn. He was an handsome chap, strong and sturdy and fat. So I walked over to him and I said, Sir.
Sir?
Yes, sir. I'm always polite when I talk to strangers. Sir, I said, I've got a bit of a problem. It's Christmas coming soon and I ain't got nothing to feed my family. I was wondering whether you could help me. And why would I want to help you? Mr. Boogledug asked. Well, I'm an hard-working man, I said, and I've just spent the last few days and nights sitting in a dark little office, nearly blinding myself by reading and collating reports about stolen jewels. And I did all that just so that I could give my family, who I love more than anything in this world, the most scrumptious meal they've ever had in their lives. So I was wondering if you could help me out. Well, said Mr. Boogledug, you sound like a good and honest man to me, and I'd be more than happy to help you out. And so he did. It was Mr. Boogledug who provided us with this scrumptious fowl which your mother has cooked for us so deliciously. Well, what do you think of that, children? That was nice of Mr. Boogledug, weren't it, Jimmy? Weren't it, Jay?
Yes.
And I think it's only right and proper that we should thank him, don't you? So, come on. Grab your knives and forks and look down at the goose. Well, come on then, Jimmy. Jane, look down at the goose and say, thank you, Mr. Boogledug.
Why do we have to look down at the goose?
Because you should always look someone in the face when you thank them. It's good manners. Go on, look down at the goose and say, thank you, Mr. Boogledug.
You mean Mr. Boogledug is the goose?
Yes, Mr. Boogledug is the goose. Thank you, Mr. Boogledug. Thank you very much.
Oh! You're mad, Samuel, you are.
You all right there, Billings?
Yes, thank you.
You enjoying yourself?
Yes, I am.
You sure? Because you don't look it.
Oh, I am. I am. But I think I'll go outside for a while. Get some fresh air.
Good idea. I think I'll go to the John myself in a while. Make some room for the Christmas pudding.
What am I doing spending Christmas with the Clarksons? What a depressing affair. All that laughter and familial closeness. Never felt lonelier in my life. I should probably have told them I was going home. They'll worry about me. They'll go out looking for me. I've ruined their Christmas. Why am I such an antisocial bastard?
Mr. Billings? Yes, of course he is. Are you a colleague of his?
Yes, I'm Detective Constable Clarkson.
It's not about work, is it? Not on Christmas.
No, Mr. Billings was spending Christmas with us. He said he'd go out for a walk and then he just disappeared.
What? Without saying anything?
Yes.
How very strange. He came back about 2 hours ago. He's in his room now. I'll see if he's awake. Mr. Billings, are you there? Oh,
damn it.
He's asleep. He takes it to go to sleep and then there's no waking him up.
Well, never mind. Let him sleep. At least I know he's all right.
I'm so sorry he walked out on you like that. It's very rude.
Nah, it's my fault, really. I shouldn't have invited him. I knew he didn't want to come.
Well, he could have at least said something.
I'm sorry to have bothered you on Christmas Day.
Oh, it's no bother at all, Mr. Clarkson. I'm glad there's somebody else out there worrying about Mr. Billings.
Oh, such a bastard. Why do I do it? Why do I chase people away, only to complain about being lonely? Oh, it's this business with Jacobs and Sebastian. I can't deal with it. Two lives completely ruined. Not by misfortune or circumstance, but by their own reckless hands. Oh, it's like that quote from Robinson Crusoe, the one which so impressed me. It is a secret overruling decree that hurries us on to be the instruments of our own destruction. Even though it be before us, we rush upon it with our eyes wide open.
In this episode, the parts were played as follows. David Ault, Sean Mendham, Kareem Cronfley, Matt Sykes, Mike Young, Aubrey Parsons, Sarah Bowers, Anthony Houston, Tanya Rich, Laura Mirsky, Bob Lawrence. Audio Mystery Theatre is free to listen to, but not free to make. If you want to show your appreciation, please consider buying us a virtual cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/audiomysterytheatre. That's ko-fi.com/audiomysterytheatre. With theatre spelled the British way. That is, with R-E at the end.